So today, for our final colloquium of the term, so we're very happy that Henry Yuen from University of Toronto will be speaking to us. So Henry is in the computer science and mathematics departments at Toronto. He's interested in many topics, also of interest to us, you know, topics including things like quantum information, complexity theory, and so on. And so today, Henry has very kindly agreed to tell us about so an exciting paper that he wrote recently called MIP star equals RE. And so Henry, whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Okay, great. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, hello everyone. Sorry for the late start, but I guess it's sort of like the Zoom equivalent of finding a locked seminar room. So thank you very much for the introduction and thank you for the invitation to speak. You know, I always enjoy visiting the Perimeter Institute, and it's a real shame, especially since it's, you know, so close to Toronto. But anyhow, I hope everyone is hanging in there all right these days. So, you know, I'm excited to be able to share an overview of our MIP star equals RE result, which is joint work with my collaborators, Zhengfeng Ji, Anand Natarajan, Thomas Vidic, and John Wright. So originally this was going to be a talk of a more technical nature, but then I realized and I was told that this is going to be a pretty broad audience. So I'm going to keep this at a pretty high level. So I won't assume any particular background in complexity theory or quantum information theory. But if anything is unclear, please feel free to just ask in the chat or the Q&A. Okay, so... So this talk is going to be about the connection between three questions that seem at first glance very different from each other. One is a well-known question from operator algebras known as the Kahn embedding problem, which asks if every separable finite von Neumann factor embeds in an ultra power of the hyperfinite type 2-1 factor. So you won't need to know what these terms mean, but this is the statement of the problem. Another is Cyrilson's problem, which comes from quantum information theory, which asks if all quantum commuting correlations can be approximated in finite dimensions. And the third question comes from complexity theory, which asks if there is an algorithm to approximate the value of non-local games. And what we've learned over the last 10 years or so is that these three questions are intimately linked. So through a sequence of papers starting from Kirchberg in 93, then through the work of Fritz Jung et al. And Ozawa in about 10 years ago, we now know that there's a positive answer to this Kahn embedding problem from operator algebras, if and only if there is a positive answer to the Cyrilson's problem from quantum information theory. And furthermore, if they do have a positive answer, this implies the existence of an algorithm for these things called non-local games. So in this talk, I won't discuss von Neumann algebras at all or this Kahn embedding conjecture, but instead I'll focus on this connection between Cyrilson's problem and this complexity question about non-local games. And ultimately, our MIP star equals RE result rules out the existence of an algorithm for these games. And that implies that Cyrilson's problem has a negative answer. And so therefore, so does the Kahn embedding problem. So to explain this connection, let's start from the beginning. I'll have to explain something, what these correlation sets are and what Cyrilson's problem is. So, Cyrilson's problem is about quantum correlations. Now, first, what do I mean by a correlation? It's a mathematical model for the behavior of a physics experiment involving two separated systems, these two green boxes, box A and box B. And we think of each box as taking in some input, like the box A takes an input X and box B takes an input Y. These inputs are one of k symbols, and each box produces its own output. The inputs are one of n symbols, and the outputs are one of k symbols. So we should think of the input as abstractly telling each box to perform a specific measurement on whatever is inside this box, and the output is the measurement outcome. So we can describe the joint input and output behavior of these two boxes together using a conditional probability distribution, P of AB, given XY. And you know, these correlations can be represented as vectors in real space. And also an important thing about these correlations is we want to focus on correlations that model boxes that are separated far from each other. So we think of them as not being able to send signals to each other, but they can still behave non-independently. So the question from this abstract mathematical point of view is what correlations should we consider? And this depends on what your model of physics is. So if your model of physics is classical, then you get the set of classical correlations. These are built out of deterministic correlations where each box outputs a deterministic function of their inputs. Okay. And classical correlations are deterministic correlations or convex combinations of deterministic correlations. So these are relatively simple, but these are the types of correlations that come up if you want to model things using classical physics. So I'm going to let C sub C denote the set of classical correlations. So remember that these correlations are these conditional probability distributions, which I view as vectors in real space. So the C sub C is going to be the set of all such vectors. And this forms a convex set because we're taking convex combinations of deterministic correlations. Okay, so we believe that nature is not described by classical physics, but rather by quantum physics. And here the set of correlations appear to get richer, and they arise from something called a quantum entanglement. So mathematically, how do we model this? Well, quantum mechanics still says one way of doing it is we can associate with each box a Hilbert space, possibly infinite dimensional. And the joint state of these two boxes is described by a state, a unit vector psi that lives in the tensor product of these two Hilbert spaces. And when a box, say for example, box A gets an input X, it performs a measurement on its part of the state to obtain some outcome little a. Similarly for box B. And mathematically, the way we model these measurements is through something called POVMs. Okay, these are positive operators that act on the respective Hilbert spaces. When you sum up these positive operators over the set of outcomes, they sum to identity. Okay, and the probability of getting an output pair AB given inputs XY is given by this formula written in the first line. This formula depends on the tensor product of the measurement operators. So this tensor product assumption is a natural way to model this spatial separation between the two boxes. And if we think of these two boxes as representing two independent physics labs, then it's natural to say that each lab has its own Hilbert space to model what's going on inside of it. A very familiar and very natural way of modeling quantum correlations. Okay. So, these quantum correlations give rise to another set, what I'll call CQS. This is the set of quantum spatial correlations. And there's some variants on this I'd like to introduce. One is what I'll call C sub Q. This is a set of finite dimensional correlations. So here the Hilbert spaces are finite dimensional. And this is going to be a subset of the spatial correlations. And finally, there's another variant, which I'll call CQA. This is going to be the closure of C sub Q. And this is going to be essentially the set of all approximately finite dimensional correlations. Okay. All right, so that's one model. Here's another way of modeling quantum correlations. And this is called the commuting operator model. So what's different here is that instead of assigning a Hilbert space to the boxes individually, you're going to introduce one monolithic Hilbert space H, and the state of the two boxes is just some vector psi in this Hilbert space H. And you know, each of the boxes has some measurements that they perform. These measurements are again described by these POVMs that act on the same space now. And the way we model the fact that these boxes cannot communicate with each other is that their measurement operators commute with each other. Okay. So even though they act on the same space, and normally, you know, operators in general don't commute, we're going to insist that box A's operators commute with box B's operators. Okay. This model captures the tensor product model, but may include more types of correlations. And this commuting operator model is motivated by the study of quantum field theories, where, you know, given two separated systems, it's not a priori clear how to decompose their state space into a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces. But the commutation condition captures the notion that the order in which they perform their measurements don't matter. So we can, you know, collect all these correlations together from this commuting operator model and give it a name. This is this described by the set CQC, quantum commuting correlations. So, you know, I've described a number of different types of correlations, and they form this chain of inclusions. And just to, it's basically an alphabet soup, but I've written on top what these correlation sets mean. And a natural question to ask is, you know, once you introduce these sets, is which inclusions are strict? Are there correlations that can be achieved in one which cannot be achieved in another model? So, you know, famously, in the 1960s, John Bell showed that quantum correlations the set of quantum correlations is bigger than the set of classical correlations. Okay. So quantum mechanics is capable of a richer set of correlations than classical physics. Some years later, William Schlosser showed the next separation. He showed that the set of spatial correlations, you know, these are correlations described by this tensor product model. This set is not closed. Okay, so CQS is distinct from CQA. And then a year later, D'Angelo and Stark showed that restricting to finite dimensional correlations really is a restriction, there are infinite dimensional correlations in this tensor product model, which cannot be achieved exactly by finite dimensional correlations. And for this last inclusion, this is what is known as Cyrilson's problem. It asks if CQA is equal to CQC. And in words, it's asking, can all these commuting operator correlations, can they be approximated by finite dimensional correlations? So this is the quantum information theory question that Cyrilson asked. But it turns out that this question relates to some deep questions in mathematics. This CQA equals CQC question, it was connected to something in the realm of C star algebras. So about 10 years ago, Fritz and independently Jung et al. Showed that something known as Kirchberg's conjecture from C star algebras implies a positive answer to Cyrilson's question. It would imply that all these commuting operator correlations can indeed be approximated in finite dimensions. And Ozawa showed that, in fact, the converse is true. So these two questions are, in fact, equivalent. Kirchberg's conjecture from C-star algebras was proved by Kirchberg himself to be equivalent to this Kahn embedding conjecture, which was formulated in the 70s. So there's a surprising link between, these math questions and this quantum information theory question that was formulated by Cyrilson. Okay, so that's Cyrilson's problem. Now let me turn to non-local games. So non-local games are kind of an operational way of thinking about these correlations. It's something you can do with these correlations. So a non-local game, I'm going to describe two-player non-local games. It's abstractly given by two pieces of information. There's a question distribution mu. So this is some joint probability distribution which you sample inputs x and y from. I'm going to call these inputs questions. And these boxes are supposed to produce answers A and B, which are then, you know, you take the questions and answers and you check whether the boxes win according to some decision predicate D. Okay, so you can imagine given these two boxes, which may share some correlation, you can play a game with them where you sample the questions, they generate answers according to their correlation, and you check whether they win or lose according to this decision predicate. And you know, given a game, the boxes, you can think of the boxes as trying to maximize the probability of winning a game by picking an appropriate correlation to use. Okay, we also think of these correlations as being strategies for the boxes. So, for example, if I had a game G and the players chose some correlation P of A, B given X, Y, then you can measure their success probability via this formula. I mean, so this omega G of P just says, well, what's the probability that if I sample questions X and Y and they generate answers A and B according to this strategy or this correlation, that they generate a winning pair of answers. So their maximum success probability depends on what kind of correlations they're allowed to use. So for example, if you restrict the boxes to using classical correlations, then this gives rise to what's called the classical value of the game, what I'll call omega C of G. So you just say, well, what's their maximum success probability where P ranges over the classical correlation set. If we allow them now access to quantum correlations, you know, the two boxes can take advantage of quantum entanglement to, you know, produce answers in this game, then we get what's called the tensor product value. So here we're going to take the supremum of this success probability over all correlations in C sub Q. So remember that C sub Q is the correlations that can be achieved using finite dimensional tensor product measurements, okay? But since we're taking the supremum, this is really the same as optimizing over the closure of C sub Q. So this is the same as optimizing over CQS or CQA. And finally, we can talk about a third value, which is called the commuting operator value, what I'll call omega QC of a game. So here, this is allowing the players to use general commuting operator correlations to play this game. So, you know, since each of these correlation sets, you know, form like this chain of inclusions, we have that the classical value of a game is at most the tensor product value of a game, which is at most the commuting operator value. But, you know, sometimes they're the same. And the question is, are there cases in which these three different values might differ from each other? Okay, so, you know, here's an example of a non-local game. Probably many of you have heard of this or seen this before. This is called the CHSH game. And this game was essentially formulated back in the 60s by Clauser, Horn, Shimany, and Holtz. And they formulated it as an experimental test of whether nature is describable by classical physics or, you know, some hidden variable theory. And this game is very simple. So the questions X and Y are uniformly random bits. Okay, they're independent. The answers produced by the boxes are single bits. And the decision predicate for whether they win or not is if the parity of their output bits is equal to the AND of their question bits. So, you know, what do we know about this, this game? Well, the classical value of CHSH is 3/4. But if you allow the boxes to play, you know, to share quantum entanglement, they can actually win with higher probability, 0.854. And, you know, one of the significant things about this game is, you know, people have experimental tests of it. So they actually, you know, have physical labs representing these boxes. They play this game and they do observe a winning probability that's strictly greater than 3/4, which tells us that, you know, however nature is behaving, it cannot be behaving according to a model of classical physics. Okay, so, you know, so this is some some background about non-local games. And now let me turn to the question of whether non-local games are computable. All right, so back in 2004, some computer scientists, Cleve, Hoyer, Toner, and Watrous, and, you know, as we know, Cleve and Watrous are just down the street from PI, they're IQC in Waterloo. You know, they asked the following question. Is there an algorithm to approximate the tensor product value of non-local games, right? Or, you know, in other words, if I handed you a description of a non-local game G, could you tell me what the maximum success probability in this game is if you allow quantum strategies? And so here we're going to focus on finite dimensional strategies. You know, so is there an algorithm to do this? And maybe you say, okay, maybe it's too much to ask for computing this optimal success probability exactly, but maybe up to some precision parameter, epsilon. And, you know, it's a very natural question from a computer science point of view. You know, if we knew that this question had a yes answer, you know, there is an algorithm, then you can go on to ask, you know, if there is, what is the fastest algorithm? If you can solve this problem, what other problems can you solve? Can approximating omega q be reduced to solving some other problem, right? So these are the types of questions that are very natural from a computer science perspective. And, you know, just to, you know, give some motivation for, you know, where did this question come from? Well, it's very naturally motivated by stuff that people have been looking at in classical theoretical computer science for a long time. So, you know, back in the 70s, Steve Cook, you know, who famously discovered this phenomenon of NP completeness, proved, I mean, he didn't formulate it in this way, but one way of saying what he proved is computing the classical value of non-local games exactly is an NP complete problem. Right. And, you know, fast forward 20 years, it was shown that even approximating the optimal success probability with classical correlations or classical strategies is still an NP complete problem. And, you know, this is significant because this hardness of approximation is known as the probabilistically checkable proofs theorem or PCP theorem. And the reason it's called that is because this theorem has an equivalent formulation, which says the following. It says that proofs of mathematical statements can be encoded in a robust format such that the correctness of the proof can be checked by only examining 3 bits of the proof at random, which is, you know, kind of a mind-blowing fact. And, it turns out that this is equivalent to this NP completeness of approximating this classical value of non-local games. And, you know, I'll get back to this PCP theorem later. So, you know, back to this, you know, quantum value of game, right? This omega Q, we want to find, you know, figure out if there's an algorithm to approximate it. So, you know, there's a trivial, you know, back to this, you know, there's a trivial algorithm to compute this classical value in exponential time. One can simply enumerate over all possible deterministic strategies for the players. Okay. So this is some, you know, this is a trivial brute force algorithm, but it's not clear if there's a similar brute force algorithm for the quantum value of a game. And in fact, one of the things that Schlosser showed in 2017 is that there's no algorithm to compute omega q of non-local games exactly. Okay? This was a consequence of his work on showing the separation between these the correlation sets CQS and CQA. So there's something very different here about these quantum correlation sets. You know, what Schlosser showed is that gave some indication that these quantum correlations is much, much, much more complicated than, say, classical correlations. So, what about approximating, omega q? Okay, so we know Schlosser showed that you can't compute it exactly, but what if you wanted to approximate it up to some plus or minus, say, 10%? And, one of the barriers to even trying to do this in a trivial brute force fashion is that there's no generic upper bound on the dimension of correlation you would need to win optimally in any given game, right? So if someone hands you a description of a non-local game and say, I want you to play optimally, you wouldn't know whether you would need a strategy with, say, two qubits or three qubits or 100 qubits or a million qubits. So if you were to try to do a brute force enumeration strategy, you would just continue searching over larger and larger dimensional strategies, but you wouldn't know where to stop. Okay, so now, so this is the computability question about these optimal success probabilities of non-local games. And this is where things connect back to these questions I mentioned earlier. So this Kahn embedding problem is equivalent to Cyrilson's problem, like I mentioned. And it turns out that if there's a yes answer to the first two, this actually implies the existence of an algorithm for non-local games. And so I'll describe this algorithm right now. And it combines two procedures, one called search from below and one called search from above. So the search from below procedure is sort of this attempt at a brute force solution to approximating this optimal success probability. So what you can try to do is just enumerate over larger and larger dimensional strategies. Okay, so this search from below will just compute this infinite sequence of numbers, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, where alpha d is going to be the optimal success probability if you restrict yourself to d-dimensional strategies. And for a fixed d, you can actually compute, at least or approximate that number. What we know is that as you increase d to infinity, eventually alpha d will approach from below the optimal success probability of your non-local game. The search from above procedure gives also computes this infinite sequence of numbers, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, that are all upper bounds on the not the quantum value, not this tensor product value of the game, but the commuting operator value of the game. Okay, and this each of these beta d's, the definition of them is that they're the best upper bound on the commuting operator value that can be certified by sums of squares of degree d polynomials and non-commutative variables. So it's rather abstract sounding. The important thing to know is that for a fixed d, you can compute it using semi-definite programming, using something known as the NPA hierarchy. And the thing we know about the sequence beta d is that it approaches the commuting operator value of non-local games as you crank d up to infinity. Let's put these two procedures together. We can approximate omega q, this tensor product value from below, using these alpha d's. We can approximate the commuting operator value using these beta d's from above. And if the commuting operator value is the same as the tensor product value, then in fact these two sequences will converge, in which case you will have homed in on the true success probability of the game. Okay, So in other words, if Cyrilson's problem has a yes answer, if these commuting operator correlations can be approximated in finite dimensions, then this algorithm is guaranteed to converge at some point, although there's no guarantees on the convergence rate. Okay, so good. So you know, this shows the connection between Cyrilson's problem and Kahn's embedding conjecture to this computability question. Okay, so before I go on, are there any questions?
Yes, I don't see any any hands raised or anything.
Okay.
You can go ahead, Henry. Thanks.
Alrighty. So you know, this brings us to the statement of our the main statement of our result. So MIP star equals RE can be formulated in the following way. There is a computable map from Turing machines to non-local games where if you walk up with a Turing machine M, then this I can compute a description of a non-local game G sub M where if this Turing machine halts, meaning that you know you just start running this Turing machine and at some point in time it's going to just stop, then the tensor product value of this non-local game G sub M is equal to 1. Right? There's going to be, you can win with probability 1. Whereas if you turn on this Turing machine M and it never halts, then the tensor product value of this non-local game is going to be at most a half. And this number half, it's not so important. It can be replaced by any constant that's less than 1. The important thing is that there is a difference in the tensor product value of this game, depending on whether M halts or not. Okay, so what are the implications of this? Well, you know, one of the things that was proved in, you know, Turing's seminal paper in 1936 is that there is no algorithm to solve the halting problem, right? There's no algorithm that can determine whether any given Turing machine will eventually halt or not. So, you know, this means that there is no algorithm to approximate this omega Q value for any epsilon, because if you could approximate omega Q, then you could distinguish between whether, a given Turing machine halts or not, right, using this reduction. So in particular, this search from above, search below algorithm that I described earlier cannot converge for all non-local games G, right? So what this means is that there has to be some game out there for which the tensor product value of the game is different from the commuting operator value of the game. And this implies a negative answer to Cyrilson's problem. These two correlation sets, the finite dimensional ones or the approximately finite dimensional ones is different from the commuting operator correlations. And by the equivalence that was discovered about 10 years ago, this implies that the Kahn embedding conjecture is false. Okay, so let me just give a few more details about what are about the implications. So, like I said, you know, there's some game out there that where the tensor product value of G is strictly less than the commuting operator value. And for all the games that we construct, the commuting operator value of those, what we actually know is that there's a game for which the two values differ, tensor product versus commuting operator. And we know that the commuting operator value game has value is equal to 1. Okay. So there's the strategy. Commuting operator strategy with success probability 1, you cannot approximate in finite dimensions. So one way of interpreting this is that it shows in principle there is an experimental test for infinite dimensional physical systems. Okay. What is this experimental test? Well, you would actually just run this, try to play this non-local game experimentally. just like you would play the CHSH game experimentally. And if you play this game and you happen to observe that the, you know, whatever physical apparatus you're using to play this game is winning with probability one, consistently, then, you know, this gives you strong evidence that you cannot model the physical apparatus using a finite dimensional system. So, you know, I say that this shows in principle there's such an experimental test. Well, you know, our result doesn't actually say how to carry out this experiment in the real world. Okay, we don't actually say how you would actually build this physical apparatus. It just says that potentially could be, you know, it could happen. Okay, so I'm running a little short on time, so I'm going to skip this next part. And sort of say a few words about how we prove our result. And the main, the technical tool that we use is something called the recursive compression of non-local games. So I'll try to give some sense of sort of how one proves this. Since we're trying to encode Turing machines into non-local games, it'll be very useful for us to also have a Turing machine representation of non-local games. So remember that I said, described non-local games as given by these two pieces of information. There's a question distribution, this mu, and also a decision predicate D, which is a function of the questions and answers that are that show up in the game. So we're going to assume that this question distribution and this decision predicate can be represented by a Turing machine or by some computer program. So there's, when I say I walk up with a non-local game, I'm really walking up with some computer program that tells you how do you sample questions from this question distribution and how do you compute this decision predicate D of X, Y, A, B. Okay. If we model non-local games this way, then there's a very natural complexity measure, which is, how long do these programs take to run, right? So the complexity of a non-local game is really going to be the upper bound on the running time of, sampling the questions and also computing this decision predicate. Okay, so, just a little bit more notation before I describe this compression procedure. I'll also want to have a way of describing an infinite family of non-local games. So if I had, non-local games G1, G2, G3, and so on, I'm going to say this family can be uniformly generated by a single Turing machine, G hat, if you take this Turing machine and you stick in the index n, it's going to output a description of the nth game, G sub n. Okay, so this G hat is a Turing machine that takes in a number n and outputs a description of another Turing machine. Okay. All right, and the second thing is something I'll call an entanglement lower bound. And this is going to be a function of a non-local game and some success probability P. And this is the minimum dimension entanglement correlation that you would need in order to achieve success probability P. So just to give a concrete example, like the CHSH game, if you wanted to win with probability 3/4, the dimension needed is 0 because you can just use a classical strategy. You don't need any quantum entanglement at all. Whereas if you wanted to get this 0.854 value, you would need two-dimensional entanglement. And to win with probability 1, well, that's not possible in this, with any quantum correlation. So we say that the entanglement needed is infinite. Okay. So now we have everything we need to describe this compression theorem, right? So here's the informal statement. It says that there's some computable map, okay, that I call compress. And what does it do? If you walk up to me with a Turing machine, G hat, that specifies an infinite family of non-local games, And you know that each of these non-local games have polynomial complexity, meaning that, you know, the time it takes to compute the questions and compute the decision predicate is only polynomial in n, which is the index of your game. If you walk up to me with such a family, then I can compress it. I can apply compress to g hat, and it's going to output another family of non-local games, these f sub n's. And these new non-local games have the following property. So what is the complexity of f sub n? Well, it's going to be smaller. It's actually going to be polylogarithmic in n. Okay. So the complexity is exponentially smaller than each of the original games g sub n. And the relation between g sub n and f sub n is the following. If there was a perfect winning strategy for g sub n, then there also is a perfect strategy for f sub n. Okay, so we call this the completeness preserving property. And finally, there's a relationship between the amount of entanglement you would need to play f sub n to win with probability a half, and the amount of entanglement you would need to win g sub n to win with probability a half. And in fact, there's two lower bounds going on here. You either need 2^n dimensional entanglement, or however much entanglement you needed to win g sub n. So, or, you know, or the maximum of the two. Okay, so you know, the thing to keep in mind here is that this compressed procedure, you know, compresses an infinite family of games to another family, and you know, the reason it's called compress is because, well, we're really doing this complexity reduction on each of the individual games g sub n. Okay, so so this is the main technical tool we're going to use. I'm going to show you how we use this compression theorem to prove the ultimate you know, MIP star equals RE result. Okay. So this is what we're going to do. I'm going to define this family of games G sub n. So each game G sub n does the following. So you know, first fix your Turing machine M, okay, your favorite Turing machine, that you want to determine whether it halts or doesn't halt. So this game G sub n is going to first run the Turing machine M for n time steps. And if M halts within that time, this game is going to automatically accept. I mean, you know, normally in this game, you would talk to the two players and but here you actually just, you know, don't even really talk to them. You just automatically let them win. Okay. Otherwise, in this game, the verifier is going to, you know, run this compression procedure. So it's going to compute the compression of itself. So it's going to compute the compression of g hat, of which gn is, you know, it's a member of this infinite family. It's going to compute this compression, and then it's going to play this non-local game f sub n plus 1. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, first we need to argue that this family of games that I've described, these g's, you know, you can apply the compression theorem to. Okay, so it's not too hard to see that the complexity of each of these games I've described is going to be polynomial. So, you know, you just look at the three steps that are run in each of these games. Well, the first step, you're running some Turing machine for n time steps. Well, that's going to take polynomial in n time. The second step is also going to be, you know, it's actually constant time because you're just computing the compression of some, you know, some fixed Turing machine g hat, right, which doesn't depend on n at all. And finally, this third step, it just takes polylog n time, right? Because that's, you know, the complexity of f sub n is just polylog n. Okay. So, you know, all these games g sub n really take polynomial time. Okay. You know, now we get to the interesting thing, which is we want to, you know, we've defined this, you know, this family of non-local games. We want to understand what is the optimal success probability in this game. So what is omega Q of G sub n? Well, there's two cases. One is that m halts in some time t. Suppose that we take n to be at least t. Well, what is the value of this game? Well, it's going to be 1. And that's because we always just accept in step 1, right? The Turing machine m has enough time to halt, so the game will automatically let the players win, right? So that's the easy case. Well, what if this index n is actually less than t? Well, then, in which case step 1 always passes on to steps 2 and 3 of this game g sub n. So this game G sub n is always really the same as this game F sub n plus 1. And so the values of these two games are going to be the same. And now we apply the compression theorem. So, we know that, G sub t has value 1, right? You always win. And the compression theorem promises us that f sub t will also have value 1, but that sort of percolates downwards, and it tells us that this game g sub t minus 1 also has value 1. Okay, and you can just rinse and repeat, and you can just deduce that no matter what index n you have, due to the compression theorem and also due to the way that we set up this game, all of these g sub n's have value 1. All right, let me cover the second case, and then we'll be done with this proof. So the second case is that m never halts, right? So in which case, the step 1 of this game, it really doesn't matter. So every game g sub n is going to be exactly the same as the game f n plus 1. So in particular, that means that the dimension lower bound for each of these games G sub n is the same as the dimension lower bound for F n plus 1. And now we're going to invoke the compression theorem. So, one of the lower bounds on the entanglement needed to play F n plus 1 it's whatever entanglement you need to play G n plus 1. And again, if you sort of just combine the first two lines, you deduce that the entanglement needed to play G sub n is going to be at least how much ever entanglement you need to play F sub m for all integers m. But we also know by this, the other part of the dimension lower bound is that E of F sub m is going to be at least 2 to the n. And, basically the upshot is that the amount of entanglement you would need to play G sub n is going to be greater than any finite number. And so that means there's no finite dimensional strategy that can win, succeed in G sub n with probability a half. And what that means is that, this tensor product value of G sub n for any n is going to be at most a half. So, that completes the argument. We have now a transformation from Turing machines to non-local games, right? I'm just going to take, every game M and convert it to the first game in this family G sub 1. And it has this property where if M halts, then there is a strategy to win with probability 1. If M doesn't halt, then all strategies succeed with probability at most a half. So that's how we use this compression theorem. I'm out of time, so I won't really explain how we prove this compression theorem. Clearly this is kind of a powerful tool that one can use. I'll just say that at the highest level, there's two ingredients that are used in it. One is we use something called the rigidity phenomenon of non-local games, and ingredient two is this thing that I mentioned earlier. It's this classical PCP theorem, and it plays a very important role in this compression theorem. Okay, so this brings me to the end of my talk. There's a bunch of open questions that I think are very interesting. The first one is, it'd be nice to have a simpler, shorter proof of our result and maybe, also of the consequences of a result, to say operator algebras and so on. A very interesting question from the math perspective is to actually construct an explicit counterexample to this Kahn embedding problem. Okay. I should mention my personal favorite open question here is a complexity theory one. One can ask about the complexity of this class MIP-CO, which is essentially the complexity of approximating the commuting operator value of non-local games. So this whole result, MIP star equals RE, says that to approximate the tensor product value is essentially complete for, it's equivalent to the halting problem. And the conjecture that we have for the commuting operator value is that it's equivalent to the non-halting problem. Okay, and this would imply that this MIP co class is equal to co RE. And the amusing thing about this, if this were true, is that the CO on both sides would refer to different things. I'm out of time here. So, thank you very much for your time. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Henry. Virtually. Okay, so let's open up the forum for questions. So please feel free just to unmute yourself, or if you want to, you can also just raise your hand by pressing the raise hand button. Mike, are you speaking?
It's Alvaro. I have a question. Yeah. So, Henry, thanks a lot for the talk. It was nice. Can you elaborate a bit more on like what this Kahn's embedding conjecture means for? Well, not a conjecture anymore, I guess. Means for operator algebras and what's the importance of it?
I'm definitely not an expert. I don't have much background in operator algebras, but I guess the from what I understand, the significance of it is, it was originally formulated in the operator algebra community, but people realized over the years that it has many equivalent formulations in different areas of mathematics, like group theory and ergodic theory and C-star algebras, and it sort of just kept on popping over up and up in different settings, and so it was quite pervasive. It also has, a number of interesting consequences. For example, if the Kahn embedding conjecture were true, then it would imply that, essentially all finitely presented groups have this property being hyperlinear, which would mean that they're very nicely understood. They have these nice finite dimensional approximations, even though the groups themselves might be infinite. And essentially, I think, morally, this Kahn embedding conjecture or, the Searlesen's problem is really just about can these abstract infinite dimensional objects, which are seem very complicated outset, you would hope that maybe you could understand them in terms of finite dimensional approximations instead of in terms of matrices, finite dimensional matrices. And that would have been, very nice because we think we have a better feel for finite dimensional matrices. I think that's my understanding of what why it's considered an interesting conjecture, interesting question.
Awesome, thanks.
I have a question.
Hello?
Yeah, is someone speaking?
Yeah. So one question is that this half that you mentioned, the game value, either one or half, could you reduce half further? Could you make it much, much smaller?
Oh, yeah. So the half is not, you can make it an arbitrarily small constant. So, 0.01 or 0.0001, whatever constant you like.
I see. But it should not scale down with game size or something.
Your favorite universal constant, that's less than one, you can make that half that constant if you want it.
Thanks.
I've got a question about when you talk about the complexity of a game, there are these predicates, which are the set of questions which the players have to answer. And so you ask, like, how many times do they have to give us an answer for each of the questions? In some non-local games, we treat that the inputs of the two players are independent. And therefore, you can sort of say, if to find some distribution for Alice and for Bob, which allows them to put their inputs in a product form and then see the game this way. Or in other cases, we allow for sort of correlated inputs where they have to implement their measurements separately, but they can choose how to put their inputs in a correlated fashion. So in a non-local game where you have the referee essentially assigning the inputs, are you imagining the latter form, which is a non-local game where the inputs can be correlated?
Yeah, so definitely. In our formulation, yeah, we allow general correlated inputs. That's what this distribution mu is for. And it's actually quite important that in all the games that we deal with, the questions are not independent. They're correlated in very special ways. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
So, hi, Henry.
Hi.
I have a question about variations of the the question to set up, taking into account energetic considerations. So the motivation is something you mentioned, that in principle there could be a experimental setup that distinguishes these two sets of correlations. And I suppose if one actually think about doing the experiments, then energetic constraints come into consideration, because to manipulate infinite dimensional systems, we need to consider energies and the constraints it imposes. And this sounds like a physical problem, but maybe there's a way to formulate this kind of problem in a mathematical or computer science or information theoretic language, especially given the recent advances in quantum information community reformulating quantum thermodynamics. So I wonder if the people had considered variations of the setup with energetic constraints.
That's really interesting. I'm not as familiar with the quantum thermodynamics literature, yeah, I mean, I agree. It'd be great to have as you mentioned, this energetics thing seems like it's a physical consideration, I guess, a very, one that you encounter very soon. I think it's a great question to see if there's like a more purely information theoretic, obstruction to running an infinite dimensional, test. Yeah.
Thanks.
I have a question, Henry. This is Claude.
Oh, hi, Claude.
Hey. I'm not sure I quite got everything, but one thing I'd like to understand is, does your proof ultimately provide a game which has commuting operator winning probability of one and cannot be won just for finite dimensional quantum correlations?
We can pin down a specific game with that separation you described. What should be true, and I think this is a very, I didn't have time to talk about this, but what should be true is that for every, you know, so in this slide that has the reduction from Turing machines to non-local games, for every Turing machine M that does not halt, it should be the case that the commuting operator value is equal to 1. We don't know how to prove this, but we can construct a different game which does have that property.
So not only do you have one candidate, but you have tons of candidates there, because there's one for every non-halting Turing machine, right?
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. I'm even more impressed than I already was. Thank you.
Okay, so any more questions for Henry? Okay, well, if not, thanks again, Henry, for a fantastic talk.
Thank you.
And thanks everyone for attending. So this was our final colloquium for the term. So then I guess I'll see all of you in the fall. Okay, thanks so much for coming.
All right, take care, everyone.